close to a quorum here, and they'll be rolling in. Today, the main order of business is to have the Minnesota Department of Health presentation of the governor's budget, and I think we can also get the public testimony for folks who want to come and give their thoughts on the MDH budget. Just to orient members, there are a couple of things that have been handed out. One, we're going to ask council to step us through. Members had asked for a better look at the FTEs. There's a couple of pages of that that we'll go over with members later on in the hearing, but they are available to members. As we go through the Department of Health budget, we have a couple of documents before us. There's a handout that is an overview PowerPoint followed by the MDH version of Fast Facts, I guess, is what we'd have to call it. Budget Fact Sheets is the majority of the handout that's in our packet today, and that is to supplement the material that we got from the MMB budget tracking sheets. There is a tab in our binder for the Department of Health, so we'll have to, you know, try to reconcile and get the Department of Health to give us the clues that we need to get on the right page of both the MMB documents and the Department of Health documents as we go through. But we should be able to accomplish that. And then also available to members is the very high-level MDH budget tracking document that we can use for reference as we go through as well. The budget facts and the budget tracking document are not yet collated into our folders and our budget books, but staff will be working on that in the next day or two. We'll punch holes in them and get them incorporated into our books. We just received them. So with that, we will welcome Commissioner Ellinger. And Abigail Reed. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to overview our budget. I'm Dr. Ed Ellinger, the Commissioner of Health. Abigail Reed, our Chief Finance Officer, is here along with a variety of our staff. Also joining me today is Jonathan Reed, a student at St. Olaf, who is going to be going to medical school soon, and I'm trying to convince him that public health is really the way that physicians can really make the biggest difference. So he'll watch our proceedings today. What I'm going to do is briefly give you a little overview, sort of the conversation that I had with the governor as we were kind of working through the budget to try to get the things in that we wanted. And so I've got a few slides, and they've got the slides in front of them, right? That really kind of gives the background of how we put our budget together and the thinking that we had in terms of putting that together. The second slide say, why invest in public health? And I think I've shared the story with you that as a physician seeing patients, I quickly realized early on in my career that we could be doing a lot of treatment, but it really wouldn't actually impact the overall health of the community. There are too many other things going on affecting the lives of people in terms of the quality of the food, the safety of the environment, water quality, air quality, violence, injuries, a whole variety of things, tobacco use, alcohol use. And so I early on decided that the best way to do that is to really integrate medical care and public health approaches, some of the treatment along with the prevention. And that's the philosophy that we build our activities on as we look at the main functions of the Minnesota Department of Health is we do the health protection activities, really things related to acute diseases, but also the health improvement activities as we look at how to intervene with the chronic conditions, the obesity, the diabetes, the heart disease in our society today. So it's that integration of the medical care and the public health that we see as the way to move forward. We particularly use that when we're talking about health reform that we've been doing in this state since 2008, where we really need to have a balanced approach. The slide on page three, the third slide, shows the longevity of folks. And this really sort of makes the case that we really do need to have an integrated medical care system and public health system. This shows the life expectancy over the last 100 years. And we've gained about 30 years in life over that period of time. And 25 of those years, it has been determined, are really due because of public health efforts. the working with clean water, infectious disease, immunizations, food safety, motor vehicles. And a lot of that was at the beginning of the century where we had acute diseases, but also in the latter half of the 20th century where we did a lot of work with smoking cessation, had tremendous impact on smoking cessation, reducing smoking. And that was probably one of the biggest reasons we've had an improvement in heart disease outlooks and reducing the rate of increase of lung cancer. It is because of those public health issues. The next slide shows a little different portion of how we look at longevity. This is a slide that shows the length of life of countries throughout the world and compared to the dollars that they spend per person per year on medical care. And the x-axis, excuse me, along the bottom, it shows how much we spend per capita on health care. And on the left is life expectancy. And you can see the United States way on the right in the upper right-hand corner. which shows that we spend more money by far than any other country, but yet we don't have the best public health or we don't have the highest longevity in the world, so that we're not getting the best bang for the dollar that we have. And that's the reason for that is highlighted on the next slide, which shows the comparison of total health and human services dollars in various countries throughout the world. And we always say that the United States spends more money on medical care, but we don't spend the most money per capita or as a percent of our GDP on total health and human service spending. We're sort of in the middle third of that. That shows that chart shows that the United States spends about 29% of its total GDP on health and human services. The difference is that way over half of our total health and human services dollars goes to medical care. And less to public health and social service. And compared to other countries, we're only one of three countries that spends over 50% of our medical care, total health and human services, on medical care. And we're arguing that we really need to balance that. As we look around the world, the places that get the best bang for their buck really have a much more balanced approach where they have an investment in medical care, an investment in public health, an investment in the human services that really look at all of the characteristics and components of health. And that's what we built our budget on and talked with the governor about is how do we get this balanced approach. The next slide shows the determinants of health and where we spend our dollars today. On the left, it shows that of the determinants of health, the thing that really predict how healthy we're going to be, only about 10% of those determinants are medical care. Genetics makes up about 30%, but behaviors and social circumstances make about 55%. Over half of the determinants of health are really behavior and social circumstances, things that are not amenable necessarily to medical care, but to really to public health interventions. And yet, despite seeing that with that really what determines health, about 88% of all of our dollars go into the medical care piece. I argue that we have the best medical care system in the world. In Minnesota, it's the highest quality, lowest cost, best access, but yet we're not the healthiest state because we've not invested an appropriate amount in some of the prevention activities. We're 48th in the country in terms of state investment in public health. And I think that is what we've argued with the governor, and that's the point that we made when putting our budget together, that we need to invest in some of the prevention activities. We need to move upstream in where we put our dollars. The last slide that I'm going to go through shows what we would predict in the modeling that it has done is if you do just the medical care piece, just access to medical care, the red line, what would happen with costs? You could see that costs would go up dramatically. If you add the prevention services, you know, the things that you do in the clinic to add prevention activities, many of the things that aren't covered by insurance in today's world, you could see costs would go up even more. It would certainly have a bigger impact on lives saved, but it would cost a lot more to enhance that medical care package. But if everybody had access to care and you did the preventive services and you did the community prevention services, the things that we're going to be talking about, things like SHIP, the immunization programs, smoking cessation programs, raising the tobacco tax to decrease smoking use, you'll see that after an initial investment of costs, the costs are going to go down. This is really the only way that we're going to be able to reduce costs is by actually focusing some of our activities, some of our efforts, some of our investment on the prevention aspects. So with that background, that's what I see that we need. That's the argument that we've talked to the governor, and we really appreciate the governor's investment in that approach with including the tobacco tax and including SHIP in the budget. And Abigail Reed, our chief financial officer, will go through some of the specifics of the things that we put into our budget. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Abigail Reed. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I'm going to start on the last slide in your packet and then move to the fact sheets. And so the last slide just gives you an overview. Mr. Greenman's been here before to talk about our base budget, and it's about $1 billion on a two-year basis. And so what this slide shows is what the governor recommends in terms of changes to that budget. And so it starts at the top. It says MDH fiscal 14-15 proposed budget. And what it shows is that we have about a $59 million change on the spending side. That's really composed largely of the SHIP program, restoring that to statewide and continuing it into the future. Then there's another $9.5 million that's really changes to our regulatory and screening programs. There's some updates, some expansions, some reforms there. There's another $7.7 million for clean water activities. Those aren't in the jurisdiction of this committee, so we won't focus on them today, but to give you a sense for that size. And then $2 million in general fund dollars for our core public health initiative that we'll talk about. It's really to offset some federal cuts and other changes that we're experiencing. And then that amount of spending is offset by a small amount of rent savings we'll talk about, and then about $9.4 million in revenues, which are largely fee changes that go with those regulatory and screening programs. And so what that brings us to is a net proposed change of about $49.6 million. And so moving to the fact sheets, they actually provide some additional information, some additional background rationale for the items you'll find on pages 6 through 11 of the governor's budget document. So we're not going to work from the governor's document today, but if you're looking for our items, they're on pages 6 through 11, I believe. And I'll provide some overview. We certainly have experts from the programs here to answer more detailed questions, so if I phone a friend, don't be surprised. And also, I'm happy to take questions along the way, or we can hold them to the end, whatever the chair prefers. So, and we'll start then with the largest item in the package. It's the SHIP program, Statewide Health Improvement Program. It's something the committee is familiar with. It's, as you know, a national model that uses sustainable approaches and proven strategies that really tackle the leading causes of death now and into the future, which are those chronic diseases like obesity, tobacco use, and chronic diseases caused by those things, obesity, tobacco, and physical inactivity. And I know you've heard the statistics before, but it probably bears some mentioning again in this context. Nearly two-thirds of Minnesotans are overweight or obese, and childhood obesity has tripled in 30 years, which is basically a problem that's been created in one generation. Chronic diseases are estimated to cause 35% of deaths and 75% of all U.S. healthcare spending, trends that remain true in Minnesota as well. Even in our state, which we all know is kind of above average in all ways, we have the same impact of tobacco use and obesity in our state. We spend $2.8 billion on tobacco-related healthcare costs and $2.9 billion in economic costs related to obesity. And as you've heard the commissioner say, chronic diseases like diabetes, stroke, heart disease, and cancer really are kind of the equivalent of the polios and other issues that we dealt with in the first half of the last century. And unfortunately, unlike a lot of those, they can't really be cured with a shot. But we do know the cure. It's things like good nutrition, exercise, avoiding tobacco use, and excessive alcohol use. And that's really where SHIP comes in. It helps people change those behaviors and change them in everyday places. If it was easy to change those behaviors, we all would have done it by now. And so what SHIP does is work with local governments and tribes to help create the policy systems and environmental change that help people make healthier choices in their everyday lives. And really focusing in four places: schools, communities, healthcare facilities, and work sites. Those are the four settings that the program works in. And we provide the grants to community health boards, the technical assistance, and the evaluation to make sure that those grant dollars are used really effectively to make those changes that are most proven to improve health and help people make healthy choices. And really, it's a slightly different model than you might see elsewhere, because instead of telling people to exercise more, the program works with city planners or other folks to create more walking paths so that there's more opportunities to exercise more. Similarly, instead of just telling kids to eat healthier, the program actually helps get farm produce into schools and things like that. So the easy choice is the healthy choice. And some of the biggest advocates of the program are actually those businesses who've implemented worksite wellness programs with the assistance of SHIP. And they appreciate that because it helps employees be happier and more productive at work, plus it reduces their healthcare costs. So that is generally the overview of SHIP. In this case, we are investing $40 million over the biennium. It's a base of $20 million per year. About 16.8 of that per year would be grants, and the remainder goes to the technical assistance and evaluation and other services to make sure that those dollars are spent really well in the local areas.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there another opportunity to ask questions about the program as far as what other states are going to be
I think we have time to dig in as we go on. I mean, we'll have to watch time as we go. But
sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I didn't know if there was another opportunity. Commissioner, could you get us some information if this is obviously a wonderful program, I believe, and that has been implemented before its time. Are there other states that are looking at mirroring this, copying this?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, this is a national model, and in other states are looking at what Minnesota is doing. And in fact, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Tom Frieden will be coming here later on this year to look at this program. Several other states have started to implement parts of it, but have not taken it to the same level that we've done in this state.
Oh, Mr. Chair, could you, Commissioner?
Yeah.
Could
Senator
you give
Rosen.
Us the states that are looking at this, please? A copy of a
Mr.
List.
Chair, Senator Rosen, I'll get you a list of the places. These are what we're using are national strategies that have been identified through putting prevention to work, one of the initiatives of the Centers for Disease Control, communities putting prevention to work, and steps to a healthier Minnesota. So several of the states have used those, and I'll get a list of you for the places that have implemented those and places that have implemented multiple of those strategies.
Thank you. The next item, then?
So the next item in the packet is the core public health proposal, and it actually has four components. So what we've done is broken that down into a fact sheet for each component to make sure that you have the information that you need. And the first one is related to our lead poisoning prevention program. So overall, the initiative is $2 million out of the general fund. This first item is $200,000 per year of that, per biennium of that. And what this whole proposal does basically is address four critical threats to our public health infrastructure. And I know infrastructure is kind of one of those ubiquitous government words, but in this case, it actually does do a nice job of explaining what we do. We really have this kind of system to keep bad things from happening, or if bad things do happen, to make sure that they are resolved quickly and orders restored. And so we have a new communications director, and I was telling him the other day that I feel like he has a hard job because people don't notice when we do our jobs well. When we do our jobs well, it means that we've kept something bad from happening or we've contained it when it happened, and that's a little hard for a communications director to highlight. But he's doing a good job. So the first item, lead, is related to a program that we've had for a long time, and it's actually the foundation for a number of related programs across multiple state and local agencies. And we've actually received federal funding for our lead program since 1994, and it supports statutory requirements to identify children who've been exposed to lead, and adults as well, respond with education, medical case management, and other outreach services. And we also provide a variety of data on lead exposure to a variety of organizations like the MA program, the health plans, Head Start, folks like that. And unfortunately, the federal money has been reduced and actually even eliminated. And yet the problem remains. So in 2011, for example, over 3,000 children in Minnesota under the age of 6 were reported to have blood lead levels in excess of federal guidelines. And so without the intervention that we can help them get connected to, they are at risk for learning disabilities, behavioral problems, and at extremely high levels, even more life-threatening problems. And so what this would do is support one of our existing FTE, who are a full-time equivalent staff person, who would do data collection, help connect people to the services that other organizations provide, and also some primary prevention work. And so this certainly doesn't go all the way to restoring the federal dollars that we've lost, but we would use this amount of money and try to leverage some other partnerships. We're also looking at some strategies that would balance some of our core activities like this with the cost of some of those outreach activities. So we're looking at a variety of strategies. This would be one component of that.
That's good, I think. I mean, I know Senator Benson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When did the federal funding go away?
Ms. Reed?
This year.
It said September 1st, 2012 in the proposal here.
Okay, so the change in all funds from previous biennium to current biennium, do you have that number?
Ms. Reed?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to try to phone a friend on this one. The reduction in the federal dollars. If we don't have it today, we can
okay.
get that for you.
You
it's
said
not
this
on my
was,
sheet.
This was supporting an existing FTE, and so I was wondering if the FTE was a federal dollar FTE, and we're backfilling that, or I'm just trying to figure out why we're having an increase in an existing program and if we're matching federal dollars. So we can get that information.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, that is exactly what's happening. So we had some federal dollars to support this program, and basically most of this $2 million is actually backfilling for federal reductions to our programs. And so this person would be, or the staff position would be shifted to state funds under this scenario. And that's really what you'll start hearing from us, I think, as a theme going forward, is as the federal government is looking at their programs and looking at where to make cuts, we have a choice before us as to whether these are still important public health programs for our state, and if so, how do we want to make up the difference? And we certainly recognize we bear some of the responsibility to get creative and to think about how we can do things differently, but we do need some state funds to leverage those activities.
You know, the SHIP program and on these core public health, all four of them, it looks like I see the same number in each year, 14, 15, 16, and 17. Are these all intended to be continuing efforts, or are they specific allocations just for those years? And are they going to go into the governor's base? Is that what the proposal is going to say?
Yep, Mr. Chair and Senators, that is our intent.
Okay. Thank you. All right, the second of the core public health.
Yeah, the second item relates to our infectious disease laboratory. So for those of you who've been over to the lab tour, it's connected to one of our buildings by Skyway. And it is a $200,000 per year initiative to and it's one of two you'll actually see in this packet to stabilize lab funding. And the lab has experienced a steady decline in funding over the years, and that really threatens our ability to rapidly and accurately detect as well as respond to emerging threats. And so what this funding would support is two existing staff, again, the testing supplies, the IT support, kind of the maintenance of the high-tech equipment that is used for testing in a variety of areas, such as foodborne disease, tuberculosis, rabies, and STDs. The IT money will actually help cut the reporting time for the lab results by 1 to 2 days, which will contribute to responding more quickly to infectious disease outbreaks. And, you know, the lab has a variety of funding sources. There's federal money mostly targeted to specific activities. We have paying customers for some kinds of tests. And state support is really necessary to draw that all together and to provide that foundational kind of capacity to do the work. And with the erosion of money for this area, we need to revisit how much state support we can provide. And also it helps us to attract that other funding to make it overall work. And just as a note, the law does require healthcare providers to report to the lab specimens suspected for certain suspected infectious diseases. And under this proposal, that would remain the case and that we would continue testing those for free. And it's important because we don't want any sort of financial disincentive to folks sending those specimens in. So this proposal, along with another one you'll see later, really help us make sure that the lab can be sustained and to continue doing that important work. The next item is related to our cancer reporting system. And this is a $350,000 per year proposal to replace a 25-year-old database. And what that database is used for is it's the foundation for a program where we monitor the occurrence of cancer in Minnesota and describe the risks of developing cancer. We inform health professionals and educate Minnesotans regarding specific cancer risks and answer Minnesotans' questions and concerns about cancer, which is probably the most high-profile activity you've probably heard about related to this program. We also promote research and guide decisions about how to target cancer control resources, making sure what we are doing to control cancer is the most effective strategies and the most cost-effective strategies. As you can see from that list, that this database is really essential to what we do at the department, and it's extremely challenging to replace. We must track a vast amount of information in a way that protects data privacy and meets a lot of state and federal guidelines. And the funds will actually support a public health scientist to do kind of the design and the analysis and to help us determine what's the best way to replace it and then also the implementation cost of doing that replacement. And it's really important to do this now. You know, we all try to keep our systems running as long as possible. But in this case, our system is so old that there are few IT staff trained to maintain it. It's also not flexible enough to manage changes, rapid changes in the healthcare system, and changes in what people are looking for out of the cancer data that we provide. So that is that proposal. And moving to the last one in the core public health area, it's for our regional local public health offices. This is another $350,000 per year. It supports, again, existing full-time equivalent staff, 3.25 of those staff that are in our district offices. We have 8 district offices around the state, and these folks are the public health nurses, the emergency preparedness coordinators, and the epidemiologists who really provide specialized expertise to local departments. We have a federated system of delivering public health services in Minnesota where we serve as the central lead agency and provide a lot of that technical expertise and the connection to the federal information and expertise. And then these district office staff are key in disseminating that to the local level where a lot of the services are actually delivered. And so, again, we are facing the loss of federal funding that has partially supported this activity for a long time. It's the Preventive Block Grant. And so while we still have some of those other funding sources that support these offices, we are shifting those around. But, again, we need some additional state support. It won't go all the way to backfilling those cuts, but it'll go part way to help make sure we can keep that funding balance and keep these staff working for the local governments. And as the commissioner has traveled around the state, he has mentioned that this is one of the things he hears most from the local governments in terms of services they appreciate from our department.
You know, before we get off these core public health functions, these are, replacing historic federal receipts, and I know that the sequestration issue is not off the table. These are losses that have already occurred, and then there's additional potential significant losses on the horizon as well, correct? Or is any of this regarding future potential losses? Are we going to need to shift gears again and reprioritize if as we go down the road? Just trying to get a context for what we're looking at. I mean, we have some serious issues.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have already taken some federal cuts. And we evaluated all of the cuts that have already been made and sort of looking down the road to see what cuts might happen with sequestration. We know that there are going to be additional cuts. So we really evaluated what is absolutely essential for the state to maintain and had prioritized those, recognizing that there are going to be some things that we're just not going to be able to sustain on an ongoing basis. And we certainly know that state funding will not be able to make up for the loss of the federal funds. But we really tried to articulate the ones that are most essential in order to maintain the systems. You know, for example, the cancer surveillance. Cancer is the leading cause of death in this state. Because of the efforts we've done related to heart disease, that has gone down, but cancer is there, and that is one where we really need to pay attention. The lead program, particularly since we have some of the highest lead levels in the state, had the most recent death from lead. It's one of those core things that we have to do. So we will be probably identify as we get more cuts coming back to you, identifying where we're going to be make additional things once we know more from the federal level what we will not be getting in terms of funding.
Thank you for that. Senator Benson?
And Mr. Chair and Dr. Ellinger, legislative speak is sometimes different than outside this room. When you say federal dollar cuts, are they cuts from a forecast, cuts from a promise the Fed's made, or cuts from the base that we'd been receiving?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, the cuts are true cuts, like the preventive block grant, which had been in existence for a long time, is gone away. The lead grant, which we had had for a long time, just went away. It was not a reduction in anticipation. It was just elimination of some of those. And some of the other grants that we've had have reduced the dollar amount that we receive from the federal government.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next item.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll move next to the newborn screening item. This is the first in the section on regulatory and screening programs. And what this initiative would do is really strengthen the newborn screening program, and it would add two new tests for particular diseases and increase educational outreach and also fix a structural deficit in the fee account that supports the program. And that deficit has been caused by kind of declining birth rates at the same time costs have been increasing for the program. So what this would do is increase the appropriation by almost $2.2 million per year and add those two new tests, which are recommended by the federal government, as well as a state advisory committee that's been set up to advise the commissioner on adding new tests. And the first test is SCID, or Severe Combined Immune Deficiency, and I am definitely going to deflect any questions on what that is to the commissioner, but it's often called bubble boy disease, and it's a group of conditions that cause severe inability for the immune system to function and fight infection. So it often is the cause of chronic diseases that lead to death. And long-term survival for children treated before 3 months of age is actually 95%, but without screening, diagnosis is usually delayed and leading to worse health outcomes and tremendously expensive health care costs. It costs about $2.2 million on average per child with a late diagnosis, as opposed to $250,000 on average per child when the condition is caught early. And so in this case, the federal government paid for the startup of adding the new test, but the state is responsible for the lab equipment, the testing supplies, and the staff to administer those tests ongoing. The second test is called CCHD, or critical congenital heart defects. And these are particularly serious heart defects that require surgery within 1 year of birth. And by testing, though, the blood oxygen levels, we can detect those conditions early before visible symptoms emerge, which allows for quicker follow-up and treatment, again, before the risk of disability and death become much greater for the newborn. Again, the feds paid for the startup of this test, but the state is responsible for the costs of technology, reporting, and follow-up going forward. So the appropriation also covers more education and outreach. We found this is most important to the program because the effectiveness really depends on a partnership between the Department of Health, the providers who actually administer the tests, and then parents who are responsible to bring their children in for follow-up and to take care of those conditions going forward if there is a presumptive positive. And the new staff that this will pay for will educate parents and providers about program changes, create more public awareness about how the program operates and the impact it has on babies' lives. And to support these efforts and to fix the deficit in the fee account, the newborn screening fee would be raised from $106 per specimen to $140 per specimen. And that's a fee that's charged to hospitals and midwives and the providers that deliver the babies. And since this cost is passed on to insurers, I know when DHS was here previously, they're tracking a small item in their budget. That is the medical assistance impact of passing this cost on to third-party payers. And I believe in their budget, that's $792,000 in this biennium.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that cost of $792,000, that is to the state of Minnesota. Do you have a number on what this cost would be overall? I'm assuming the cost of $792,000 for the state programs, the additional cost that we would pay. What about the private sector?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, the fee of $140 per specimen would be passed on to the third-party payers and others for about the 68,000 births and tests that are done in the state each year. So the 792 would be the public share of that. The remainder would be the private share.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, medical assistance pays for about half of the births in the state as of right now. So I'd anticipate a similar dollar amount would be in the private market.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you.
We'll move to the next item, which is the home health care reform. And this, it may be familiar to you, we had a similar proposal in the governor's budget last year. Although it was not adopted in the HHS bill at that time, we were directed to bring it back as a fee-based proposal to this legislature. So what you see in this initiative is what we were requested to bring back this year. And what this does, it protects vulnerable adults, other consumers of home health care, by ensuring that the settings where they receive that care are safe, protected, and free from abuse and neglect. And what this does is really reforms and updates the program. We've actually regulated this industry since 1987, and the industry provides a broad range of services for people of all ages, in homes mostly, and could be anything from simple activities of daily living like bathing and administering basic medications to actually specialized healthcare services that are delivered in the home. What this initiative would do is update the law, reset the staffing ratios at the department to actually match what is really tremendous growth in the industry. We have now about 1,500 providers that are regulated, which is a 209% increase since 1995 and a 24% increase since 2007, showing that the growth continues. And right now we have only 9.25 full-time equivalent staff, which only inspected about 108 providers at 185 locations in 2011, but also investigated 331 complaints, 95% of which were substantiated, so that's an important service. And we also currently have four license types. Some providers actually need two license types in the current environment, and some of those license fees were set almost 20 years ago. So really what has led us here is starting in 2007, the legislature directed us to create a work group to recommend some changes to fix these and other issues that they were seeing. And those recommendations of the work group are reflected in this proposal. And what the proposal would do is allow us to inspect providers every 3 years. And particularly for those new providers in the market, we would offer them a temporary license for their first year of operation and make sure that we inspect them during that first year. We would also streamline the license types from 4 to 2, just basic and comprehensive, and also increase the application requirements for new providers to make sure that when they are providing care, they are ready and prepared to do so safely. And also, we would clarify, actually, we have the proposal to clarify statute and then create a much clearer website so that everyone knows what's required of them. Everyone knows what it takes to provide care that's safe and protects vulnerable adults. It would also create an advisory council that would advise the department on changes in the industry and future policy changes to our regulation. And just a note, because this is sometimes an area of confusion, this is not the same as DHS's HCBS, Home and Community-Based Services waiver program. There's actually very little overlap. Sometimes people are wondering, are we regulating the same thing as them? Actually, little overlap, although we have identified 140 providers who otherwise would require two licenses. And so part of what you'll see in the language carried on the DHS side or ours is a way to make sure only one license is required for those providers. So the Department of Health would actually enforce the DHS requirements during a transition period where we make sure we get those statutes fixed up and correct to make sure that there's only one license and one entity regulating those providers. So in summary, it supports the staffing levels necessary to do this work, streamlines the program, and make sure everyone's focused on where they need to be focused. The providers are focused on providing safe care, and the state is focused on enforcing those requirements. Any questions on that one?
You know, I guess I have a question. Tell me more. You say that these are going to be distinct groups of licensed individuals that from the Minnesota Department of Health, DHS licensed home and community based service folks. So, what is the funding? What are the services these individuals are providing as distinct from the home? Because I was confused about that, and so maybe you could elaborate just a little.
Mr. Chair, members, that's why we wanted to bring it up, because we want to make sure that we don't end up with some confusion here. We've actually been regulating the home health care industry, which provide the kind of services I talked about, the in-home activities of daily living and the some of the specialized healthcare services. We've been regulating that industry since 1987 through our compliance monitoring division. Recently, through some requirement changes at the federal level, DHS is also required to license some of the services that are offered in those settings or similar settings, and I might need to phone a friend soon. but what we've done, the folks in compliance monitoring and in DHS have worked very hard to make sure that there's no overlap, so that there's not two licenses now required with the new proposal DHS is coming forth with this year. And what they found is only 140 of those providers would overlap. And so they worked together to come up with some language to make sure that we would be administering those additional DHS regulations for those providers. And that way they're only having one group inspecting and licensing them. That will require some additional changes in statute that we'll be working on and bring forth later. This will be a transition. And I think we have additional questions. Yeah.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Winkleman. I'm the Assistant Division Director in the Division of Compliance Monitoring in the State Health Department. And what Ms. Reed started to explain to you was what we're somewhat calling, or at least temporarily calling, an integrated license concept. As she described, there have been our proposal that we've been working on with the providers and a variety of stakeholders for many, many years to restructure and make better our home care licensing program. And maybe a couple of years ago, the home and community-based services licensing proposal was begun in DHS as a result of a CMS directive to improve their waiver standards. And so last fall, a group from our licensing and in compliance monitoring and a group from DHS licensing got together to figure out exactly what sorts of conflicts might we have between the two proposals. We were obviously concerned. What we discovered was that actually the services between the two proposals are different. I'm hardly an expert about what the DHS waiver services are, but my understanding generally are that they are rehabilitative and sometimes instructive versus actually providing care to the recipient. So that's a kind of a general difference. But one of our concerns and what we discovered was that there were 140 providers who are licensed by Minnesota Health Department now as home care providers, who are also on the rolls for having received waiver reimbursements in the past year or so. So what we set out to do was decide that we were not going to require those 140 providers or any others similarly situated from require them to get a second license. We don't know exactly how this is going to be hammered out over the next year, but we have a commitment from both agencies and leadership to come up with one license. Maybe it's an integrated system between the two agencies. We have interagency agreements. We're going to make it work. We're going to have one fee and one license. So beyond that commitment, and there will be language that will appear in the DHS article, in the HHS budget bill coming out soon. So we are working on how to roll that out. Of course, we'll be getting provider input, and all the details are hardly worked out, but we're developing a work plan now.
Thank you. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Could you just briefly, I see in your bullets under the proposal you're talking about clarifying licensing requirements related to medication management and staff competency. Could you you give me a little broader understanding of what it is you're looking at there and what that's likely to look like when it comes in front of us?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon. Medications management, well, this proposal really is an overhaul. We're restructuring the licensing. We're taking four different types of licensing and making them into two, and along the way, we've really revamped a lot of our requirements. One of the things that we're noticing on site as we're encountering more and more serious problems is that there is a problem in the area of medication management. So we're very, very concerned about sometimes very dire consequences that can occur. So what we're developing, and the language as I recall, is to put into place more documentation requirements about dosages, who gets what, policies and procedures for our staff so that they understand who they're to talk to about refills, who they're to talk to about dosage, who the primary care physicians are. So it's really a documentations requirement for tracking the medications, tracking refills, and also having some good policies in place so people know who they're supposed to talk to.
Thank you.
I'll look forward to seeing what this
yes.
is.
All right. The next item. I'm not sure how many items you have left when we don't cover the clean water so much, but I'm hoping that we can get done with this by around 9:45 to leave time for testimony. I'd leave it to you as to whether we're on track or not for that. Are we doing all right?
Mr. All right. Chair members, I think we have four or five left. So.
Okay, we'll stay the course then with the level of questions we've seen thus far.
The next item in the packet is the healthcare facility blueprint review. And this is in our regulation of healthcare facilities in, again, the compliance monitoring division. And this is actually a new fee related to an existing activity. So we currently review architectural, mechanical, and electrical plans for healthcare facilities before construction begins. And it's actually a really useful service that we provide. It affects a total of about 1,100 facilities. It's hospitals, it's nursing homes, it's boarding care homes, residential hospices, and freestanding outpatient surgical centers, those sorts of facilities. And what we do is actually review the construction plans for compliance with state and federal standards, do it well in advance of construction, make sure that the physical plans are tailored for the provision of health services, and it covers bedrooms, corridors, construction, materials, toilet facilities, heating, cooling, those kinds of things to make sure that the construction will proceed and meet those standards, because what those folks building the facilities don't want to have happen is to spend all that time and money to build them and then not meet the standards and have some fairly expensive efforts to mitigate those problems. And right now, all the health facilities actually pay for this as part of their license, their overall licensing fee. And what we're proposing to do is pull this activity out and create a separate fee for it. This is similar to other states like Wisconsin, North Dakota, Michigan, Washington, that do this already and charge it as a separate fee. Because it's a valuable service, the facilities would likely be comfortable paying it, and because what we do is kind of make sure that they avoid costly errors. We currently we're expecting the fees to range from about $30 to $4,800, depending on the size of the construction and the facility. And partly this will help make sure that our licensing fees are set at an appropriate level to match our costs going forward, which we are required to do by law. It helps address another one of those deficiencies in our fee accounts.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question on that. Once this new fee is implemented, will the licensing fee decrease by that amount?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, the licensing fee would not decrease. And what this is doing is help us actually balance our costs better against the fee levels that we have. There is a projected deficit in this account, and so this is one of the strategies we can use to make sure that we are setting those fee levels appropriately going forward.
Mr. Chair, to me that sounds like a double increase. But it sounds like a double increase. We're charging them this fee out of the licensing fee now, and we're going to implement a new one, but we're not going to reduce the existing fee. So.
Senator Rosen, you had a question as well?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if there was some construction plan specifications that were implemented and required by these facilities. I would assume the assisted living facilities. I don't know of any. No, I should take that back. There are some nursing homes that have been built recently, but mostly assisted living centers have been the primary construction plan going forward. Do they have a set of specifications that they have to use? This apparently will have some new specifications. Is that correct? And what have they been using in the past?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, you're talking about assisted living settings, and that is a title designation for housing with services. Housing with services does not go through a physical plant review through our division, so it is not actually included as part of this.
So, Mr. Chair, so the
Senator Rosen, follow.
And Ms. Reed, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Ms. Winkleman.
Ms. Winkleman, okay, thank you. So the assisted living centers are being constructed without any guidance and supervision and certification, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, my understanding is that all building construction would go through some sort of building code review by the locals and perhaps by Department of Labor and Industry, but I'm not sure exactly who does that review. But in terms of what is required in statute to go through our division for part of this broader health care facility review, Housing with Services does not have a physical plant component. Though now I'm thinking about it, I think some Housing with Services might have a lodging license, and then those would be physically inspected by a different division, Environmental Health, within the Department of Health. So maybe that is okay, helpful.
Might have to look into that more.
Senator Sharon, did you also have, or you just going to let it go? Or
I'm thinking about fee on top of fee on top of fee, which is what I think we're all concerned about. I mean, how many reviews somebody has to go through, and if in this case this review supplants other kind of reviews, if they're given a permit to build, in your processes, or other permitting processes that they have to go through in order to either improve or build. You know, what are we asking in terms of review processes, not just for licenses for services, but also for the facility itself? That if we need to do this, which I think we should, that we're not doing it over and over and over again in multiple places. So I'm just curious to know if this is another on top of another on top of another.
Fee. Another
review, therefore another fee. Like, is there a local permitting process that's going on? Is there building code, state building code processes going on that are reviewed under another division? And then this is another review that's occurring in the Department of Health, so that it's looking over the blueprints over and over and over again by multiple departments.
Let me tease this out a little bit and help formulate the question a little bit as it comes to me as well. And maybe this isn't helpful, but I think these are reviews that have been ongoing through the Department of Health to make sure that that all of the requirements that have come in statute are looked at by the Department of Health, so that these facilities can have the assurances that they'll meet the actual health code for the specific purpose for which that building is designed, which may not be caught. There isn't a really robust statewide building code. There's areas that really don't have much of a building code at all. That's largely local. There is a statewide electrical code. You know, there's plumbing codes, but there's all these different pieces that occur locally that give us a patchwork. But then we also have a state regulatory environment for care facilities, and I think that this probably is a valuable service that has been provided for a long time, is what I hear the department saying, and it's been, you know, it hasn't been charged specifically for these entities that are developing blueprints. It's been tried to be covered with the existing licensing fees spread broadly, but the licensing fees aren't covering all of the compliance monitoring that is being done. That's what I hear being said, so maybe we can just address the fee on top of a fee and directly. I know I'm hearing that from several members and also have concerns about that. But
And Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much, because I didn't explain it very well, and you did a very nice job of explaining it. And so basically that's the situation we're facing, is that we charge sort of one fee for the total licensure of these facilities, and we have been using that fee revenue to cover this and other services that we provide. In looking at the fact that the fees no longer cover all of the costs of our program, we're required by law to come back periodically and bring you recommendations about how to reset our fee levels to match our costs. In doing that analysis before coming before you, the program recognized that a better way than to just raise the total fee was to actually look at this particular service, use a model that's employed in a number of other states to charge fees directly for the service because it's been considered valuable by the industry over time. And so when faced with the choice of what fee lever to push to make sure this program can be sustainable going forward, that was the recommendation. And Ms. Winkleman can address the interaction with local codes if you would like that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Regarding the other components of building construction review, there is a building code, and the Department of Labor and Industry reviews, I'm not sure to what degree, but they do have a role in this. And when they are doing a review, that also affects a healthcare facility that we're reviewing. We do it concurrently, and we're in contact with them during that process. So we're making sure that we're in communication with our counterparts at the Department of Labor and Industry during that part. I can describe for you what the engineers described for me about what is the difference between the building code and the healthcare facility construction standards. And really, the building code is like the foundation of it. And then there are special buildings that have special physical plant requirements, such as healthcare facilities, such as schools, such as prisons, such as storage facilities. And as I'm telling you each of these types of special buildings, you can see why they would have a different physical plant layout, different requirements for ventilation, different requirements for where people reside next to each other. And so that is what we're reviewing, is the different health and physical plant standards for the healthcare facilities that we regulate. And then what we're doing is we're doing it way before construction starts on the design and healthcare facility part of the building, so that the facilities can change their blueprints and prevent very costly mistakes or problems that might lead to not being certified by CMS. So that's the intent, and that's what we're accomplishing.
Okay. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Winkleman, I'm reading about the fee and that it will range, depending on the plan, from $30 to $4,800. And it seems like it's a real good service, but it also seems like a service. I don't see that it's actually required to go through the review, and it sounds to me like perhaps it might even be optional. So would a fee being tacked on there make some architectural firms skip the review? And is that something that you've considered?
Mr. Chair, Senator
Ms. Winkleman.
All of the facility types have rules that require them to submit their plans. And so they probably wouldn't. The information from our engineer group that works most closely with the designers and developers throughout this process very, very early on. In fact, there's a starting process, a preliminary plan review that we would not charge for. That's the initial conversation, the what can I do? That wouldn't be part of this. But this is something that the designers and developers and architects very much want. Nobody wants to go down the road of building something that costs whatever it costs for that facility, $10,000 to millions, and then end up having a costly mistake to correct.
You know, I actually worked with a facility that was in that position, had an existing structure that was later discovered to not be in compliance, and it was a big, big, big problem. Senator Carlson, a follow-up?
Mr. Chair and Ms. Winkleman, then that I got the impression that you're saying that there is some sequence of events here that does either imply that it's required or where it is required. Am I mistaken on that? Because it does say that if this fee is not imposed, that the department may cease the reviews. So is there a sign-off stage that requires this?
Mr. Winkleman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, the rules are somewhat variable within the facilities, and I could provide that information to you, and when the language comes out, we'll have more detail about that. They're a little bit variable in what they require at what stages, but regarding our ability to provide the service, I guess, funding decisions and priorities and other activities would dictate how much we're able to accomplish. But I think that our engineers are pretty dedicatedly wanting to continue the service.
Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question was exactly the same as Senator Carlson, because it doesn't seem to be mandatory. And if, in my mind, if a developer or an applicant wants to take that pay that extra fee to reduce the risk, then it's an optional service that the department would provide. Then the code is the code. If the code is clear enough and the requirements under the department are clear enough, then there shouldn't be room for interpretation. So it begs the question whether the requirements for these facilities are clear enough for an architect and all these types of developers to actually follow, because it is a very specialized industry. I know there's certain developers and certain companies that specialize in schools, specialize in hospitals. So is the code or the requirements for the Department of Health are not clear enough that you have to interact consistently with these facilities as they are built? So that's the question. And if it's mandatory, then it's mandatory and we have to do it. But it seems to be that maybe there's maybe lack of clarity with the Department of Health. And I'm just speculating. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Senator Franzen, there's the compliance review that we're doing is both state licensing requirements and federal. And sometimes, the requirements that their engineers are looking at would be more routine, but sometimes and very often in the healthcare field, healthcare facilities are coming up with new ideas for design all the time. Those are examples that our engineers say that might take longer of a plan review, but I think that's part of what happens within this changing healthcare landscape, that they're bringing new ideas about how to comply, and so it really isn't necessarily exactly where the outlet needs to be, how far up off the floor. There's some of that, but it's could be something more creative and require the stamp or some sort of discussion with the department.
All right. Well, I know we're going to be hearing from some of the facilities themselves in the public testimony. We will. I think it's obvious there's a lot of interest for members regarding this, and we'll work with the department and with industry as we flesh this proposal out a little bit more. With that overview, we'll move to the next item.
Mr. Chair, members, the next item is the mortuary science regulation modifications, and this is really tracking of largely policy changes in the area. The first one relates to alkaline hydrolysis, and it's actually a fiscal impact related to creating a separate regulatory standard for these kinds of facilities. And alkaline hydrolysis is a chemical alternative to crematories, and it's currently regulated under the same statute as crematories, and what this proposal would do is pull them out and create standards specifically for that kind of process. And it's important because this will address kind of the unique features of that process in terms of the chemicals and the actual process in order to protect operators and the public and protect their health and safety. This proposal is based on input from a work group of stakeholders, and when we pull that group out and create a separate statute for them, the same license fee that they're currently paying under the crematory statute will still apply. And there's actually no fiscal impact to this proposal because they'll be paying, we expect, the same number of providers and the same and the same fee level, but we're going to be tracking it separately as a separate fee program to make sure that that's clear to all involved. The second proposal is what generates the fiscal impact you see in the chart, and it's related to embalming prep rooms. And what this does is actually reduce the regulatory requirements on funeral homes. It'll no longer require an on-site embalming room, and instead those facilities can use a central location for their embalming purposes and then have satellite locations for the other services they provide, such as meeting with families and visitation and such. This allows funeral homes really to adjust to a shift in the industry. There's been a shift towards cremation. Now 50% of families choose cremation compared to 8.5% back in 2003. And so a lot of these folks are saying they no longer need the embalming facilities at each location to meet that demand.
That's an incredible shift in the 8.3 10 years ago percent using cremation up to 50% today. That's a really big shift.
And in the interest of time, we'll move to the next item, which is the cost recovery for lab testing. This is, as I mentioned, the second of two proposals to stabilize lab funding. This actually creates a cost recovery model for voluntary testing provided by the lab. And what it would do is replace a $25 handling fee that's currently in statute that is insufficient to cover the costs of the kind of specialized testing that the lab provides. And it also can't be billed to third-party insurers because they don't have a code for that handling fee. And so what this proposal would do is replace that fee with the authority to contract with medical providers to perform diagnostic testing and with other labs for reference testing. And those contract rates would better reflect the cost of the specific tests that would be performed at the request of those entities. We'd retain the exemption that I mentioned before for specimens sent under the mandatory disease reporting law, because again, we don't want any financial disincentive for providers to send those specimens because it's important to our system to detect and respond to infectious diseases. Also, this proposal will allow us to keep pace with commercial laboratories in states such as Wisconsin and Iowa, who do charge these kinds of fees and do these contracts, and that will reduce the burden on the general fund where customers are able to pay. The next item would be the Environmental Lab Accreditation Program, and this is a policy change to that program. And it that program actually works to ensure that environmental labs throughout the state have the policies, procedures, equipment, and practices to produce reliable data, which is really important because the data from these labs is actually used for enforcement actions related to environmental health. And so what this proposal would do is allow the department to contract for a portion of that total accreditation process, and that portion would be the assessments. Our department would continue kind of the overall oversight and administration of the program, reviewing those assessments, proficiency testing, monitoring corrective actions, and training. But what we would do is contract with independent private companies who can do the actual assessments, which are kind of like inspections of the labs. And we would still determine and create a list of approved assessors. And then the labs who are seeking accreditation will pay those assessors directly. So what you're seeing in terms of fiscal impact is a reduction of the fee we would charge by about 40%. And instead, labs would pay directly for the assessments. And we would also reduce then staffing levels to match. And just for your information, we do accredit about 95 labs, 25 of which are out of state but require our state accreditation. Some of those we do directly, and some we just accept through reciprocity their accreditation from another state. The next item is the protecting groundwater from geothermal heat system installation. Some of you may remember this from previous years. And what this does, it's a fairly simple change. It takes our current regulation of wells and borings, and it applies it to basically holes drilled vertically or horizontally. Sorry, okay. Diagonally. In the ground. Right now, our regulation includes the term vertical heat exchanger, but increasingly the installers are using diagonally bored holes, and so they are exempt from our regulation. So this just closes that loophole and then extends the same regulation and the same fees to those to those installers. And really, this is important because these holes can be dug 10 to hundreds of feet into the ground, and that puts them very near to or in groundwater. And so what we would do is make sure that those borings are done by licensed and trained professionals, that they're constructed with appropriate materials that are safer, and they're properly grouted so they don't leak, and that they use low toxicity chemicals for that heat transfer. And so having a group of folks not within that regulation does create a loophole.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I realize it's only, Ms. Rita, 150. Also, you are bringing in revenues, though, too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The whole industry is changing dramatically, so I would say that would be a wash, yeah. Okay. Sorry.
And Mr. Chair, members, moving to the lead enforcement penalty, this is, again, a fairly small change. What it allows us to do is adjust our penalty in statute to match what the federal government requires of us, specifically the Environmental Protection Agency. And it would increase our penalty to $5,000 per violation per day, although it's capped in certain circumstances. We don't anticipate using this penalty, but it is necessary under federal requirements to retain our authority to enforce state and federal standards related to lead abatement. And if that program were taken back by the feds, which is what would happen if we are no longer meeting their standards, this program would be administered out of Chicago, which is their closest area, and it wouldn't provide use the term boots on the ground. It wouldn't provide the boots on the ground enforcement that we have here to really protect the children of Minnesota. And what this authorization also allows us to maintain is about $8 to $15 million per year of federal money that goes to lead hazard reduction and healthy home activities in local and state programs. So there's a lot of local governments relying on our ability to maintain this authority. And the last item that you'll see before the clean water is just an item tracking some rent savings. We are in the process of closing one of our three metro area facilities, and that's generated some rent savings to the general fund for the department, and so that's tracked here in the budget. And then the remaining items are clean water appropriations. As you know, the legislature is appropriating those funds on a biennial basis. There's no base going forward, so we come in and work with the Clean Water Council and the governor to make recommendations for how those are used. And they're covered by another committee.
Excellent. Questions of members on the overview? Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, I just want to commend the department for on the page for rent savings that you did look at ways to save costs and combining with existing space instead of going out and leasing new space. So I do want to commend you for those cost savings.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, and Madam Testifier, we talked about the non-vertical ground source heat pump systems. When we're talking about an angle, are we talking about the horizontal boring also? Is this all ground source heat pumps, or is there some exemption there for these borings that tend to be, you could describe them as horizontal?
Ms. Reed.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, my understanding is they're all borings into the ground, and I'm looking at the folks in the back. They're nodding yes.
I think, though, correct me if I'm wrong, and we should get to this. I think that a lot of the horizontal installations are not bored installations, but are rather excavated and laid in a pipe, and then in a closed loop, and then buried and not bored. I mean, there are certainly horizontally bored ones as well, but I think that many of the horizontal installations are not bored, and we're getting at bored. I mean, just to try to – maybe I'm not adding clarity, maybe I'm adding
– Mr. Chair, the frequency of bored horizontal ones is just skyrocketed. You drill large holes on two sides of your house, and you bore from one to the next – and then you bore underneath the house and up into the basement. That's the common technology these days. It's a lot cheaper than doing a full excavation and then covering it up.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, I was reminded by the folks in the program that the top of the second page of the fact sheet does say the proposed change does not apply to dug or trenched horizontal heat exchanger systems, and that's really because they don't pose the same level of risk to groundwater because they're closer to the surface. This is aimed at those that are dug deep into the ground.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and testifier, do those requirements also cover the material, the heat transfer material that's in there? They talk about ethylene glycol in another location. And ethylene glycol going into those systems is, that is a toxic material. Do we cover that material that's in those trench systems or horizontal systems?
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, my understanding is where our regulation does apply, then we look at the toxicity of the chemicals that are used for the heat transfer.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon?
Thank you. I just was curious to know when the language for these proposals will be on our desks.
Very good question.
Mr. Chair and members, we are very close, I believe. I believe the bill is going through some of the last stages of review and should be out shortly.
Last stages of review at the Department of Health level, or it's left the Department of Health and it's stages of review at MMB or the administration? Or
Mr. Chair and members, it's definitely a collaborative effort. So I'd say it's somewhere in that range.
Okay.
Just if I may follow up, that was very clear.
I'm protecting the innocent.
My interest in asking the question is my concern about our capacity to give these bills their proper hearing this year. We're in our fifth week already, and I would very much appreciate having the information so that we can not only schedule these bills, but many other bills that DHS has that we don't have yet in hand, and bills that the members are wanting to have move forward. So we have a short time frame for moving through policy committees, and the sooner the better. Or we put at risk the possibility we won't be able to address these issues this year.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, we do take very seriously your need for the language, and we will get it to you as soon as we can.
Thank you. With that, I think we've got many more members than we did at the very beginning. I mentioned to members at the beginning that we, in our packets, and thank you, Commissioner and Ms. Reed, for that presentation. We're going to be moving on to public testimony in a minute, but members had asked about a better summary of FTEs across the governor's budget proposals, and Mr. Albrecht has put together some materials that can help us consolidate and take a look at FTE proposals that have come forward in the governor's budget. So Mr. Albrecht was going to step us through those three sheets that were in members' handouts this morning.
Mr. Chair and members, you have two sheets of paper that look kind of the same, these two that look like this. One in the upper left corner says health, and one says human services. These are from the budget pages, but the budget pages don't include the math, so I went ahead and did the math. So on the far right side where it says B minus A, that would be the number of new FTEs that the governor's proposals include. So looking at the Department of Health one, on the first line in the business area of health improvement, there would be 19.5 new FTEs for that area of the Department of Health. And if you go to the one for the Department of Human Services, there are two pieces of paper that relate to them. The first one looks the same as the one from the Department of Health. And I wanted to explain on the first line there where it looks like for the operations area it's going from over 1,000 FTEs down to, in the forecast, 396, and in the governor's recommendation, 464. That decline from the current level is artificial. It reflects the transfer of formerly DHS employees to the Minute, or the IT agency. So that's why I put NA in my math column, but there are actually 68.5 new FTEs for the operations area contained in the governor's budget. And then you can see there the other numbers for the other business areas of the department. The other page that's provided there is from DHS, and it lists all 67 of the governor's initiatives for that agency, and in the columns next to there, the number of FTEs for each year included in the budget period. And at the very top there, you can see for the first biennium, there is an increase by the end of the biennium of 192.5 FTEs for all of DHS.
Okay. With that, we will, members may have questions about that as we go through. That'll help inform the conversation. With that, I think we'll turn to public testimony regarding the Minnesota Department of Health budget proposals out of the administration. We have enough time for the standard five-minute presentation from each of the testifiers. If folks could work hard to restrict their comments to that time limit, it would help us very, very much end on time. And with that, I'll call Jonathan Watson up. And welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Watson. I am with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. We represent the state's 17 federally qualified health centers throughout the state. We provide primary care, medical, dental, and mental health services to about 185,000 low-income folks throughout the state. We serve about one out of every six uninsured patients in Minnesota. 40% of our patient base are uninsured people. My purpose today is to discuss two items of interest to community health centers in the governor's fiscal year 14-15 budget, and that is the Community Health Center appropriation and also quality measurement. Let me start with the Community Health Center appropriation. The FQHCs do receive a $2.3 million grant through the Minnesota Department of Health, and that we appreciate that it was level funded in the governor's budget request. However, today with me, I have the CEO of Westside Community Health Services, the largest FQHC in the state, Dr. Jason Fournier, who I'm just going to have him speak to a lot of what they do with existing funds and what they could do if the appropriation was increased. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Fournier.
Thanks, Fournier. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As Jonathan indicated, my name is Dr. Jason Fournier. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for Westside Community Health Services. And each year, Westside, we're located here in St. Paul, each year Westside provides services to over 34,000 unique individuals for over 131,000 provider-mediated medical, dental, and behavioral health services. Of those 34,000 individuals that I just mentioned, more than half are uninsured. And so the funding through the Community Health Center appropriations that the state provides to us as a group of community health centers is critically important to our ability to serve the communities that we serve. And more specifically, it allows us to ensure that individuals have access to primary care, medical, dental, and behavioral services that they might not otherwise be able to access within the community. Additional to that, there are supportive services that are uniquely directed towards our patient populations that tend to come from more marginalized, disenfranchised, vulnerable populations, typically of minorities groupings within at least the metro area as it refers to the community health center activities. And with that said, those supportive services include nutritional services, include social work services, connecting folks with resources relative to their basic needs. So we're very thankful that there is level funding within the budget. We'd also indicate, though, relate to the committee here that increased appropriations, if they were to be provided, would be directed towards activities that would actually allow us to do more for the patients and the communities we serve, and more specifically from a public health community-based perspective in terms of connecting people with resources from a care coordination perspective. There's a lot of good that we do within the community. We improve health outcomes for many individuals. Again, as Jonathan indicated, for 185,000 individuals across the state, the healthcare that we provide provide is high quality. But what's also of importance to us as it relates to the budget and as you're deliberating relative to it is the fact that quality measurement is extremely important. Community health centers for a long time have been involved directly with quality measurement. One of the things, though, we'd ask for consideration is that it needs to be more of an apples-to-apples comparison. And when you're comparing disparate populations, as the state does and others do who measure our quality of care, it's important to recognize that there are unique attributes to vulnerable populations that prevent folks from being able to access care and to be able to readily access services that they need. So many barriers that we help as community health centers through the CHC appropriations to minimize and decrease those barriers to care are addressed. And so what we're asking for is consideration relative to risk adjustment on quality measurements that would allow for more of a direct apples-to-apples comparison. And that concludes our testimony for this morning. So thanks again, members.
Thank you very much. Toby Pearson and Carrie Thurlow, both on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative from and the last one set the bar. I'm in exactly 5 minutes. Hopefully we can keep that up.
Mr. Chair, that sets the bar awfully high, but we'll do our best to keep on track. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for Aging Services of Minnesota. And I'm appearing today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. We will focus our comments today primarily on the proposal related to the home care licensing within the Department of Health proposals. Included in the budget proposal, as you just heard, is a revision of the home care licensing requirements and a new licensing schedule for home care providers. The home care rule revisions have been underway for some time, and as you can see from your budget pages, both Aging Services of Minnesota as well as Care Providers of Minnesota have participated in the working groups, the health department working groups, on the home care rule revisions since 2007. So let me just be clear at the outset of our comments here that we support both the streamlined home care revisions as well as the identification of additional resources to support the home care compliance monitoring system. However, we do have some considerable concerns with the proposal. We have shared our concerns with the department, and we do look forward to ongoing conversation with the department, but we do need to share those concerns with you today. I will address a few of these concerns, and then I will turn to my colleague, Toby Pearson, to address some additional concerns. The first area that I would focus on is the fee increases themselves to home care providers. You can see in your budget pages that there is a proposal to increase licensure fee for home care providers. And while there has been some general information shared with the working groups about those fee increases, there still remains many unanswered questions about the licensure fees and the renewal fee schedule. We have not yet seen data about how the department has calculated the fee increases or the projected revenue, or more importantly, how this will impact the providers themselves. This information is vital as we go forward. While it is important, again, to secure additional resources to support a home care compliance monitoring system, we do think that it is important to avoid unintended consequences. Home care is a vital cornerstone to our senior care system in Minnesota, and we do want to avoid putting out some of these providers out of business as a result of this fee increase. The second area that I would touch on also is the area of home care survey reform, which we feel is something that needs additional attention in the governor's proposal. While the governor's proposal does take steps to more fully fund the survey process, we think that there is still opportunities to incorporate additional reforms into the system. Simply put, a home care licensure fee increase on providers without significant reforms is not acceptable to us at this point. And again, this in the last few weeks, we shared some of these concerns with the department. Here are a few of the reforms that we would deem critical going forward. First, better surveyor training for home care surveyors. We are very much interested in ensuring that new surveyors and also surveyors going out to home care agencies are properly trained in home care best practices and regulations. We routinely hear from our members that it is not uncommon for surveyors to be applying nursing home regulations in these settings. Clearly, home care regulations and nursing home regulations are different, and we want to make sure that there is a good that the application of the home care rules are those that are being done and that the surveyors are being properly trained. Second, we think we have an opportunity here to best use our survey resources, the funds, basically, the revenues generated by fees, and to target those more effectively. Now, we would acknowledge that there is a great step forward, that the department is taking the step forward to target new providers by setting a goal of surveying those providers within the first 12 months of operations. We support that. But we think that there is more that can be done in looking around the country to target survey and enforcement resources more carefully, perhaps using a heavier focus on those providers that are experiencing more difficulty out in the field, perhaps more complaints, and perhaps a more streamlined survey approach for those providers that have stellar records. The last area that we would suggest is, and this is vitally important, is to establish an appeals process. Currently, there is none in home care survey regulations, and it is incredibly frustrating for providers who may have a disagreement with the surveyor and from time to time could result in overturning if there was an appeals process in place. There should be a process under which providers have the ability to appeal survey findings to a neutral entity, something that would be comparable to other administrative law proceedings. Again, I want to stress that the Long-Term Care Imperative has shared these suggestions with the department. We do await their responses to these concerns, and we look forward to continued conversations moving forward.
Thank you, Ms. Thurlow. Mr. Pearson?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota, testifying with our partners at Aging Services as the Long-Term Care Imperative. As Ms. Thurlow did suggest, we have submitted comments to the department. This ongoing process has been a very productive process, I would say. There's been a lot of communication. There's been a lot of give and take, but we do still have a couple things outstanding that we need to address as we're looking forward to seeing the final language. Today I'm going to focus on three things. First is the home care licensing with the deadlines in the transition process. Without seeing the final language, we need to raise our concern that current providers need to have adequate time to be educated on and incorporate the new regulatory process and language. 12 months would be a necessary time frame, in our opinion, for current home care providers to learn new regulations, revise their policies and procedures, retrain their staffs, modify their budgets, et cetera, et cetera. You can't just turn it over in a very short time. There's a process to these things, if we want to have it to be a productive transition. Second, we have concerns about the final language on the fines. We've been monitoring the fines, and we've been giving the department input on what we think the level of fines are. But currently, we just want to make sure that they're not too large, nor do they fail to tie to specific findings of noncompliance. The range on fines needs to be shrunk down a little bit, and they need to be tied to specific items. Finally, as you had in your discussion, the governor recommends creating a new fee to recover the cost of reviewing blueprints prior to construction or renovation projects for healthcare facilities. These reviews do ensure that health and life safety building standards are met. The fees are based on the project cost and will allow the department to better recover actual costs incurred. However, we do have concerns regarding the Minnesota Department of Health proposal, because first, we would like clarification about whether or not the proposed fee would continue to be an allowable cost for nursing facilities completing a major addition and or a moratorium project. And second, for smaller projects where the state is not providing any reimbursement, the fee would basically be another unfunded mandate that would raise, as you had your discussion, fees on top of fees. We look forward to seeing the final language to make sure that it works for everybody involved. Again, I just want to stress our willingness as Long-Term Care Imperative to continue to be engaged in this constructive dialogue. It has been a constructive dialogue with the department so far, and we look forward to seeing the final language. Thank you.
Thank you. We all look forward to the language and really digging a little deeper into some of these issues. With that, Roger Bengston with the Funeral Directors Association, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, good morning. I promise I won't take the 4 hours it took me to drive 100 miles today.
thank you for coming down.
My name is Roger Bankson, and I am the current president of the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association. MFDA is in its 123rd year as an association that represents members from funeral homes across the state. We are here today to testify on two mortuary science changes contained in the budget, Department of Health budget. The first is regarding the alkaline hydrolysis. As you had heard, alkaline hydrolysis is a newer form of disposition that is being used at the Mayo Anatomical Department and the University of Minnesota Veterinarian School for a number of years. This past year, the first funeral home in Minnesota was licensed to use this form of disposition, and we expect this to become more widely used here in Minnesota. The Department of Health convened a working group over the past several months, which was were very much appreciated to be a part of. All of the stakeholders groups were well represented, and we feel the group came up with a very good policy framework. And we support the Department of efforts and look forward to continue to work with them as this legislation moves forward through this progress. The second change is more concerning to us, which involves removing the current requirements for funeral homes to have prep rooms. We have yet to see the details, but we believe prep rooms are an important part of all funeral homes and have been required by the health department in all buildings licensed by them for funeral home use, regardless of the proximity to the other locations. The preparation room is used for more than embalming, but it is a private area in the funeral home where remains are prepared for cremation and held while waiting for authorizations needed for the from the physicians, the medical examiners, and the coroners prior to cremation or alkaline hydrolysis. We understand that there may be some funeral homes supporting this change, but the majority of the MFDA members have many questions and would like to engage the department in further discussions about the concerns regarding the health, the safety, and the impact this may have on the communities we serve. We also understand that the department is currently involved in litigation regarding this issue and feel it is more appropriate for that to be resolved before the legislature makes any further changes. Thank you.
Mr. Bankston, thank you. We look forward to working with you as well as thank we you. Dig deeper into these proposals. Matt Schaefer with the American Cancer Society and Rachel Callan with the Heart Association. Callanan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Matt Schaefer. I am with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. I want to thank you today for the opportunity to testify. At the risk of stating the obvious, you're spending a lot of money, and you're going to continue spending a lot of money on healthcare treatment. But the fact of the matter is, I know this committee is going to be looking at a number of different bills which seek to expand access to health coverage for Minnesotans, and our organizations support those efforts. But we're really not going to be able to get our arms around the goals of containing costs and becoming a healthier state unless we begin making a meaningful commitment to and a meaningful investment in public health. And from our standpoint, the governor's budget begins to make that commitment. Although it's not referenced specifically in the health budget, we do want to thank the governor for including an increase in the price of tobacco products in his budget. 77,000 kids are going to try tobacco products for the first time in their lives this year, and many of them will end up addicted, setting themselves up for a life of premature illness, disease, and possibly premature death. And that costs money. That's a problem for you. That raises the risk of cancer and heart disease, which is a problem for us. Raising the price of tobacco products is the most effective means for deterring kids from taking up the habit, and so we thank the governor for making that commitment. We'd also like to thank the governor for recommending a continued funding for the SAGE Breast and Cervical Cancer Screening Program. And last year I met a survivor, her name was Brenda, at a Relay for Life last year, and I'm intentionally staying vague to protect her identity. Brenda went in for a routine physical in the middle of the week. Later that week, she found out she lost her job. Shortly thereafter, she received a call from her doctor saying, "You need to come back in for some more tests." And her first comment was, "I just lost my job. There's a lot of ambiguity in terms of what my insurance is going to look like. I think I'm going to have to put this off." And the physician said, "I don't think you heard me. You're coming in for an exam." which she did. As Brenda figured out her treatment, she was able to receive a screening through through the SAGE program, and she was able to begin her treatment. And now I'm proud to announce she's cancer-free. She's also got her job back, and she's privately insured, paying taxes. And SAGE really is a program that truly serves as a safety net for women across our state. Lastly, I wanted to speak in support of the Statewide Health Improvement Program, SHIP, and my colleague, Ms. Callahan, will go into more detail, but I recently heard a lecture from Dr. Donald Warren, the Director for Master of Public Health at North Dakota State University, and he probably explained it best. He said, health equality means giving people a pair of shoes. Health equity means giving people shoes that fit. And really, when you look at the SHIP program, that's the program that seeks to make meaningful advances toward health equity. SHIP provides grants to local communities to implement evidence-based strategies based on making the healthy choice the easiest choice across our state while giving those grantees the latitude to work with the department on figuring out what that looks like in their communities. It's not enough for us to tell kids to eat healthier foods. SHIP grantees are working on implementing farm-to-school programs, giving kids a chance to try new foods that are grown on Minnesota farms. And keep in mind, the school lunch might be the healthiest meal kid eats all day. It's not enough to tell communities to tell kids to exercise more. SHIP grantees are working on working with local communities to make sure there are safe parks and trails to ride on and play in. To close, should this legislature choose to raise the price of tobacco products, preserve our state safety net, and continue investing in public health, and your successors choose to do the same, I will say you will be well on your way to killing at least two jobs, our jobs, and we want to help. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Callahan?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Callanan, and I'm Regional Vice President of Advocacy for the American Heart Association. Thank you for hearing testimony today on the Governor's Health Department budget. I'm going to, and I would mention the Governor's budget does go a long way to address heart disease and stroke. I'm going to focus in on two of the greatest risk factors, preventable risk factors for heart disease and stroke, tobacco use, and obesity or overweight. I echo my colleagues' comments about the governor's proposed tobacco tax increase. No single thing you do this year could have a greater impact on the health of Minnesotans, and so I do urge you to pass that policy and increase the price of tobacco. But I want to focus today on another key component of the governor's budget. In 2008, there was a bipartisan and visionary effort to tackle the two factors that I just mentioned, tobacco use and obesity. The statewide health improvement program was created. Its selling points were that it was statewide and promised to touch every county in the state of Minnesota. It was evidence-based so that every strategy that communities were going to look at to implement locally had some evidence behind them that they were going to make a difference, either in tobacco use or promoting physical activity or healthy eating. It was also driven by the local community's priorities, and this was very important because a cookie-cutter approach would not work for this kind of program. And a community leadership team was appointed in each of these communities to lead that process. They were often business leaders, healthcare leaders locally that knew what the priorities were at the local level. And very importantly, it promised to begin reducing healthcare costs over time by keeping people healthy longer. The program has been underway for 4 years. It was originally funded at $47 million for the first biennium it was funded. It was scaled back by over two-thirds to $15 million this current biennium. The governor would fund it at $40 million and would sustain that funding into the future, which is great. We applaud the governor for breathing life back into that program. I wanted to share just a few examples, very specific examples of what's happening in communities around the state with SHIP. I had the privilege of attending a number of healthy community forums this summer and into the fall and winter, specifically about SHIP and the benefits that it was providing in the communities. Literally hundreds of people showed up at these community forums to learn about what SHIP was doing in their community and to share a healthy meal. Some of the examples, SHIP was the seed that was planted to create a two-acre garden at Sibley East High School in Arlington, which is in south central Minnesota. Mitchell Wensloff presented at one of these community forums, and he's a student at the school. He said that they grew over 700 pounds of tomatoes in their little two-acre garden, and they were able to use those tomatoes in the school cafeteria. So not only did the kids get a really great opportunity to be outside and learn how to garden, but they also benefited the school. Another example is the Little Huskies Daycare in Jackson, Minnesota, where Amanda Benda was able to launch a healthy eating and active child care program in her daycare. She has reached the lives of 82 children over the life of that project. And then the third example, a SHIP grant in St. Cloud, was really the impetus to build the momentum behind a significant grassroots effort in the eventual adoption of a smoke-free campus at St. Cloud State University. These are just a few of the hundreds, really hundreds of examples all around the state of Minnesota about how SHIP has impacted Minnesota communities. In closing, I would like to invite the committee and all legislators to come down to the Rotunda next Tuesday, February 12th. It is the American Heart Association's Heart on the Hill, and we will have some of these SHIP grantees and others presenting in the Rotunda, talking about their success stories and displaying some of the information that they have gathered over the time of their project. So I hope to see you there, and thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer and Ms. Callanan. We'll call Julie Myrie with Carlton Cook Lake St. Louis County Community Health Boards on behalf of the local Public Health Association. See, we have a handout. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. And
hey, good. I was thinking we needed some water earlier, so I'm hoping I clear my throat. Mr. Chair and, and committee members, I am Julie Myrie. I am the director of the Carlton Cook Lake St. Louis Community Health Board, and I'm also currently the legislative co-chair for the Local Public Health Association, which I will refer to as LPHA. I'm very happy to be here to testify to you, and I also represent local, county, public health departments across the state, excuse me, as well as tribal and city health departments. According to the CDC, or the Centers for Disease Control, 70% of what influences health status can be addressed through prevention, yet only 20% of healthcare expenditures go towards preventive measures. LPHA is very pleased that Governor Dayton's budget begins to recognize this imbalance by prioritizing a number of upstream preventive measures to health and human services. LPHA strongly supports the governor's recommendation to fund the nation-leading statewide health improvement program, or SHIP, at $40 million over the next biennium. I have distributed a press release issued by the SHIP Coalition, which is a broad-based group of local public health officials, physicians, health plans, and many other advocacy organizations, praising the governor's decision to fund SHIP levels at levels that might once again allow it to reach counties in all corners of the state. MDH staff and also the testifiers before me really did provide some information, great information about SHIP, so I won't reiterate that. I will draw your attention to the fact sheet and the press release that was passed out to you for that additional information. Instead, I'll focus the precious little time that I have on some local examples of what's happening in my region. I live in the Arrowhead. I represent the seven counties in northeast Minnesota. And SHIP has been supporting strong community collaboration to support health there and to impact health. Since it began, SHIP helped nine hospitals strengthen policies that support breastfeeding, which is readying them to reach baby-friendly hospital designation. Breastfeeding leads to decreased health risk for the baby and increased health benefits for the mother. Riverwood Hospital in Aiken, Minnesota, will be the first in northern Minnesota to achieve the baby-friendly status through the support of SHIP-funded staff. Ship staff in Carlton County worked with the Moose Lake School District to pass the first and most comprehensive walk and bike to school policy of its kind in the state. This policy provides students with safe rules and guidance for walking and biking to school. And across the region, over 1,500 students participated in the International Bike and Walk to School Day this fall. 7 schools are working on Active School Day. Over 2,000 students are impacted region-wide. This strategy focuses on active academics or 5 to 10 minute breaks. You can maybe build some of those into some of your meetings, into the school day, that foster growth and development, enhance fitness, and improve focus for young learners. Finally, SHIP staff are working with 14 post-secondary campus communities to review and strengthen the implementation of tobacco-free policies. They are also working with 16 housing and redevelopment authorities to strengthen and implement smoke-free policies impacting nearly 3,000 people. The governor understands that without sufficient funding, SHIP can no longer catalyze these and similar efforts in all parts of the state. LPHA and the full SHIP coalition agree. In addition to SHIP, LPHA is pleased to see that Governor Dayton proposes increasing the price of tobacco tax to prevent youth from smoking, help current smokers quit, and reduce health care costs for all Minnesotans. LPHA stands in support of this decision with the Raise It for Health Coalition, a group of over 30 leading health and nonprofit organizations. LPHA is glad to see an allocation for sustained technical assistance to local health departments in Governor Dayton's budgets. This partially offsets federal cuts to the preventive block grant. We are also happy to see the Healthy Homes allocation, which partially offsets federal cuts to lead surveillance. To conclude, we know that from America's health rankings released annually by the United Health Foundation, it shows that Minnesota now sits at 48th in the nation in overall public health funding. This is far too low for a state that has such a rich history of strong health care and health delivery. Public health and prevention need to be a larger part of that moving forward if we expect to curb costs and keep Minnesotans healthy throughout their lives. We are very glad that the governor sees this need and has chosen to make certain key public health infrastructure investments a priority. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Ms. Myrie, thank you for your testimony. I'm intrigued by your concept of a 5 to 10 minute break for legislators, but honestly, I think it's probably easier to get school-age children back together than legislators if you let them go over 5 or 10 minutes. I don't know. That's just been my experience. So, Senator Kiffmeyer.
I totally agreed. Mr. Chairman, I've thought sometimes of when I read about SHIP and making some of these decisions about how you live on a regular basis or they don't stick. Otherwise, they're just kind of one time, and that doesn't work. And I know we may have some K-12 educators around the room here, but I thought for a long time we kind of have this. When I grew up, we walked to school so much. I am so grateful for that. But now the bus thing, you drop them off so close to school door, you pick them up, their opportunities just built in are so slim. Yep. And it seems like even with the SHIP situation, I've thought sometimes even if they, the picking them up is pretty difficult to do any staging in that regard. But at least when they come to the school, can they be dropped off so they have maybe a ways to walk before they get into the school that can be secure and protected? I mean, I'm just curious, because I was noticing here it says, and then they select from a list of strategies developed by the Minnesota Department of Health. Well, it looks like a list of strategies needs to include things. Has anything like this ever been done or on the radar at all?
Absolutely. Ms. Myrie, yes.
Thank you, Chair and Senator. Absolutely, in our communities, we are meeting together with schools and community members to develop plans to do just that, to help kids walk safely to school. And sometimes it is creative as dropping off kids a little further away and helping them and supporting them and accompanying them to walk to school. In fact, Moose Lake did that very same thing. And it's really definitely to a community-wide effort and with school personnel to implement that and looking at the bus routes and how kids are dropped off and working with parents as well.
And I've Senator Kiffmeyer, I've seen these actually working in our local communities, and each one of them has to be a local one that works with our our local governments. It depends on where a drop-off point is, what it is. You mentioned the Moose Lake School District. I've talked with the superintendent there, who was really moved by his experience of riding bicycle. He picked up a whole bunch of kids along his route on the way in, and they were really inspired. Their parents had never allowed them to ride bicycle to school, but under the supervision of the superintendent, they allowed that. I did push him to do it more often than just that one day. I'll say that on the record. I don't know if he's taken me up on that yet. It's still a little chilly out, I suppose. But anyway, these are the types of evidence-based strategies that really can change the dynamic of how we live and how we interact as a society and break down some of the barriers. The walking school bus concept, and bicycling school bus, I suppose, safe routes to school, the complete streets policy that we have statewide, where we stop and take a look at how we invest in our transportation thoroughfares to make sure that we open them up in the best community sensitive manner as we make these to get the best use of 30 to 40 years of these significant investments. These are all strategies that we all have a lot of interest in. And so
yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Britta Orr. I'm the executive director for LPHA, and I just wanted to quickly add in response to your question, Senator, I was privileged, like Rachel Callanan with the Heart Association, to attend many of these forums, and in the city of Minneapolis, there was a specific program that does exactly what you're talking about called Minnehaha Mondays, and I'm not going to remember the name of the local elementary school conducting it, but Senator Hayden was in the room, and he may recall they are dropping kids off, something like 300, 400 kids off to walk to school together, and a young girl from the fifth grade named Claire talked to that group about it. So just wanted to give you that example. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm really glad I asked the question because I think it's encouraging. You don't know for sure when you ask a question, but I think the more we can, like your superintendent draws attention to it, shows the support for it, and that's all really good. But it's got to be on a regular daily basis, on a long-term basis, or it's like eating something really nutritious, but it tastes awful. You might suffer once, but you won't do it again. And so it doesn't have a lot of long-term nutritional value. So it's got to be, the safe, the fun. Mm-hmm. Yep. But I'm glad to hear. I'm glad I asked the question, and maybe sometime I'll get more info.
Right. Mm-hmm. Thank you. With that, we better press on here. Jack Heiderscheid. Welcome to the committee. Restate your name for the record, in case I butchered it, I suppose.
My name is Jack Heiderscheid. I'm a private citizen, and I'm here to support Governor Dayton's tax on cigarettes. I hope they raise them 60 cents, and I understand that the House has a proposal for $1.60, and I hope they raise it up there. That'll be more effective. At the age of 55, I had cancer on my vocal cord. I had 35 radiation treatments. During that time, I'd sit there every day, and I would visit everybody. Every one of them were smokers. I was the only one. I've never smoked in my entire life. The nurse couldn't believe that I didn't smoke. And going on, in 1947, seven of us from Monroe High School joined the Marine Corps Reserves. And in 1950, in the summer of 1950, the Korean War came out, and all of us, seven, were called into the Marine, activated, and in 10 days we were on two troop ships headed for Korea. We landed at Incheon, and we went up through Seoul. We came back and landed in North Korea, and the seven of us survived a winter in North Korea, the Chinese Army, and the North Korean Army. All of us came back home, and the Pioneer Press did an article about us. They called it the Lucky Seven, and this was four of them. Well, two of them here are Bob and Dick. They weren't so lucky. They chose to smoke, and they survived the Korean War, but they couldn't survive the effects of lung cancer from smoking. Bob had lung cancer, and Dick died of a heart attack. 42 years ago, I met my wife, Lois. I hadn't married her yet, but anyway, she had been married for 20 years to her husband, Richard, and he was in the army in Germany, and they were over there, and he had a heart attack. And he came home, and Lois said, his doctor told him, quit smoking. And he decided he'd just try some low, not nicotine cigarettes. And 3 months later, he died of a second heart attack at the age of 40. And then I was going to say Mary Jo and I were married before his first time for 18 years. She smoked for those 18 years. She died. She had a collapsed lung and cancer. My mother, she died at the age of 72. She smoked. My dad lived to be 99. I had my son-in-law. He was Ron. He just died here less than 2 years ago. He smoked. He got lung cancer and died. Andy, we golfed together. He got lung cancer. And towards the end, I would take him out for lunch, and he'd have to bring along an oxygen tank. Roger, my son Mike, it's his son, is his in-law, and he smoked when we first met him. Now he's got emphysema and poor health. He doesn't smoke anymore. My cousin Lorraine, she smoked and died of lung cancer. So anyway, you might think about other family members who had lung cancer, besides the smokers that are affected by all of this. And I was telling the doctor at the VA hospital, my doctor, that I was coming here today, and he was telling me about how he is near a high school and about all of the young students at the high school who are standing across the street and smoking. And when Lois and I got married in 1972, this is the picture of the wedding. And if you notice, this gentleman here with a cigarette in his hand, his name is Tom. We were high school friends. We worked together at Paper Calmus and Steel Company. And he died 15 years ago from lung cancer. He smoked. So anyway, lung cancer, heart disease, emphysema, millions of health care costs to the state of Minnesota. What better reason would we have than to raise the price of tobacco for cigarettes? And I hope we do that. And I had some handouts here, which is it's an article written by Dr. Keating, who is a cardiologist at the University of Minnesota. And I'll just read the one statement. Increase the price of tobacco is one of the most effective methods in preventing and reducing tobacco use. And anyway, if you can hand out that out, and that's all I've got to say, and I hope you raise the price of tobacco cigarettes.
Mr. Hittershide, thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your service as well. I think it really effectively connected some of the dots for us, your testimony, and thank you. Deborah Anderson and Michael Harristhal, with Hennepin County Medical Center and the Regional Poison Control Center. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. I am Mike Harristhal. I'm an administrator at Hennepin County Medical Center. Anderson is here from our regional poison control center, and that's actually why we're here, perhaps most prominently. I should also add, though, we are just delighted with the leadership and insight of Dr. Ellinger and his department, and view him as a just fantastic partner. Looking forward, HCMC, I think an awful lot of you know us pretty well. Some of you, maybe not so much, but certainly we are renowned for our safety net mission to ensure access for all. We see in our clinic system over 2,000 people each and every day. So it's a role that is very important to the people that we serve and to the region and the state overall. We're also a key to critical disaster preparedness in the event of emergencies. We also play a very prominent role in the education of health professionals. So the roles and the facets of HCMC are very multidimensional. We believe in innovation, and certainly among the things that you've seen and heard about through healthcare reform are things like healthcare homes. We were one of the coordinated care delivery system institutions, and some of you have heard a bit about our Hennepin Health, an ACO-like program that we have underway to enable us to enhance the health of the people that we serve. We're delighted with the proposals put forward to expand eligibility for programs. We think that's one key step on the pathway to having folks very healthy, able to seek and obtain gainful employment and be good, productive taxpayers. We're happy with the recognition that MRC funding is an important part of the budget. We're on the cusp of this perfect storm of a shortage of health professionals. We baby boomers are getting to the ages where we're going to need more health care. And by the way, those health professionals, also in my age group, are at those ages where they're beginning to wind down their practices. We're here today probably to reflect formidably on the intense pressure for an institution like ours, which provides a great many services through the financing of public health care programs, but those finances have been greatly reduced over time. So we basically have a good year if we're able to break even, and we are really unable, therefore, to provide cross-subsidization for our other programs that heretofore we had been able to fund out of our margin. So to that extent, we're here seeking a conversation about how we can, in fact, create a direct line of sight funding for what we think is critical to health prevention and enhancing the health status of our community, and that's poison control funding. Deborah?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Deborah Anderson. I'm the director of the Minnesota Poison Control System at HCMC. The Poison Center provides immediate medical assessment and treatment information for poisonings and for prescription drug abuse for both public and healthcare professionals statewide. In 2012, we managed over 54,000 calls from throughout the state of Minnesota. They were managed by a very highly specialized staff of experts at HCMC. In addition to the standby capacity available to all, the Poison Center is one of the most valuable resources we have when it comes to illness and injury prevention and public health. It is well documented that every dollar spent on poison control services saves an estimated $11 in unnecessary medical spending, saving Minnesotans over $26 million this past year. 92% of poison exposures in the home are safely managed in the home, preventing unnecessary health care visits and overcrowding of our emergency departments. The Poison Center also provides critical public health surveillance, emergency planning and response services, in addition to public prevention efforts and professional education. The Hennepin County Medical Center provided about $800,000 to supplement state and federal funding last year for this valuable service. Given tightening reimbursement rates and economic pressures, HCMC is no longer able to provide this subsidy to this program. We believe that a dedicated and durable funding source is needed to ensure immediate and cost-effective services for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. Twyla Braze is next on the agenda. I don't actually see her here right now, so we'll move on. Jean Lee with welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, and I also lead the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium. I first want to thank the governor because he has been very thoughtful in his deliberations as far as budget. He really cares about the people and considers what's best in moving people in Minnesota forward, as you all do. I also wanted to thank the commissioner, who is very highly qualified, and he understands the issues impacting health, which includes health care in the home, having a healthy home, and even having a home. Within the department, they have an Office of Multicultural and Minority Affairs. This is a model that should be used in other state agencies, such as Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and Veterans Affairs, because it's important in eliminating disparities and in building a better Minnesota. The Communications Department of Health has informed us quickly on contagious diseases and other important issues where the public need to be quickly informed. And it doesn't matter what age or income status a person is, everybody's health is affected. The Department of Health has programs that they collaborate with others to help the poor and low income, such as free flu shots, radon kits, and other necessities to keep people healthy, and we'd like to see that continue. They also participate with free education to help build capacity in having healthcare professionals and workers that to meet the growing demand for healthcare workers, as he mentioned, the boomers' age. Another thing that they're looking at are what they call patient navigators, people who spend the most time with families. As far as friends and families spending time with care. These are the people that need the education and training because they're the first responders. MDH is also looking at better utilizing immigrant doctors who are already licensed in other countries as an untapped resource, because we can use the doctors here, but there's some regulatory barriers that they have which other countries have overcome, but we have not. Also want to recognize that related to brain injury, we all know how Congresswoman Gifford was affected, how athletes are affected, seniors from falling, and even veterans. Even I was affected from a head injury in an attempted assault similar to Congresswoman Gifford. So that's why I have trouble speaking too. There needs to be more development in brain injury science and in the treatments. I was surprised how little they've gotten as far as discoveries. Also, more needs to be done to move mental health into the medical model. They need better testing related to gun violence prevention. And I mentioned to Department of Human Services that we could be the first in the nation to develop the type of mental health screening as part of licensing. Heart health is the number one killer. The Minnesota Department of Health had an initiative to end heart disease and stroke by 2010. I think we need to use other methods and involve community people in helping get there. When I was in Japan, I was looking at their medical devices and patents. When I was trying to look at building some medical devices, Mayo and Medtronic were also moving in the same area, and so was the University of Minnesota. They were encouraging their students to invent, to build, and to be able to produce these products and export them. In the end, health is wealth. The Minnesota Department of Health is a wise investment in building a healthier Minnesota, and in moving towards the goals to be a national leader and global leader in healthcare. But we need to recognize the community help that's needed to get them there. And it also applies to involving the community and other state agencies. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Sam Walseth. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a handout for the committee.
Okay. We'll have that handed out.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Sam Walseth, the lobbyist for the Sustainable Resources Center, which I'll refer to as SRC. SRC is a Minneapolis-based nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the cause of healthy homes. SRC's mission is to create healthy and efficient home environments and partnerships with families and communities. SRC's programs include weatherization, lead hazard education and control, healthy home solutions, and trainings. I'm here today to express SRC's support for the Governor's Department of Health budget request for lead surveillance dollars, and to urge you to explore strategies for advancing a healthy homes and agenda in Minnesota, including asthma best practices. For starters, Minnesota has a public health success story to tell. The story is one of preventing thousands of children from suffering permanent brain damage due to childhood lead poisoning. Minnesota has a track record of success in reducing the number of children under the age of six with elevated blood lead levels. The 2011 MDH lead surveillance report, which two pages were just handed out to you, shows that while the number of children tested for elevated blood lead levels rose from 35,000 in 1995 to 93,000 in 2011, the number of elevated blood lead levels actually dropped from 4,339 to 584 over the same time period. For the purposes of that report, an elevated blood lead level is currently defined as having more than 10 micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood. I want to talk about that more in a minute because the feds have revisited that definition. This public health success story can be attributed to Minnesota's attention to this issue at the state and local level with leadership from the legislature to the department through investments in lead poisoning surveillance, lead education and prevention grants, and a requirement by DHS to hold health plans accountable for testing children. Unfortunately, I'm here today to let you know, and you've heard this previously from the department, that this strong partnership has been compromised. About a year ago, Minnesota received unfortunate news that the CDC was planning to eliminate lead prevention funds that have supported our Department of Health's lead surveillance capacity. The irony of this move is that it came at the same time the CDC announced that there is no lead safe level of lead and actually reduced the elevated blood lead threshold down to 5 micrograms of deciliter of lead per blood. If you use that threshold, there are actually 3,337 children, and that's in the your budget pages from the Department of Health, who did test in 2011 above the level of 5. The need for lead poisoning prevention efforts is still very much in need. To meet this goal, the governor's budget plan includes $100,000 to backfill a portion of the lost CDC funds needed for our lead surveillance system. The lead surveillance system has been operated by MDH since 1995. This system tells us how many children are tested, how many have been exposed to lead, and what the lead levels are and in which neighborhoods have the highest exposure levels. It makes it possible for health plans to identify those children who are at risk, who have not been screened, and to make special efforts to get to them. We support the governor's request for these funds. However, Mr. Chairman, members, we are a little concerned that there may be some attempts to further backfill those dollars, and there might be an attempt to take some dollars from the lead prevention grants that the state has funded. Those funds are currently at about $485,000 per year. It's hard to tell from the budget pages if that's actually recommended or not. I don't have the detailed spreadsheets that you might have. And so I hope I'm wrong in this.
We don't have them either. We're looking for them.
I'm hoping to do talking about health prevention here. I'm hoping to do a little preventative maintenance on this one. The lead grants are funded at about $485,000 per year. You know, for instance, if you're looking for another $100,000 to backfill and fund the surveillance system, that would represent about a 21% reduction in the grants available to community partners. What you need to know is that those lead grants have been used to draw down millions, if not tens of millions of dollars over the last 15 years in federal HUD dollars. Those are important state dollars that can be used for matching dollars to bring down federal money. In addition, those grant dollars have supported hundreds of educational and outreach events that reach thousands of children and their families. These dollars supported training efforts of hundreds of workers in lead-safe work practices and hundreds of home visits to families whose children tested positive for elevated blood lead levels. When we know that there's no safe level of lead in for children, it's not the time to be cutting back on education, outreach, and primary prevention. Once brain damage is done, it's too late for that child. Minnesota must continue the strong public health success story, which has saved many a child's future and countless taxpayer dollars in health care and special education costs. Mr. Chairman and members, with that, I'll close and look forward to working with you this session.
Mr. Walsa, thank you very much. That concludes the business before the committee, and we stand adjourned.